adopted. Next item is going to be item number 200, Time Certain. And before I forget, I didn't mention my social media page. If you can withstand it, we are scrolling regularly updated information on my social media page. So for those of you who are into Twitter, go for it. Item 200.
Accept North Northeast Neighborhood Housing Strategy Oversight Committee 2019 Annual Report.
Colleagues, this year we celebrate 5 years of the North and Northeast Housing Strategy, an initiative to address the legacy of displacement in North and Northeast Portland through investments in new affordable rental housing, opportunities for first-time home buyers, and retention programs for long-time residents. While there have certainly been challenges over the past 5 years, and this council has not been shy or reluctant in any way to identify those issues, there have also been many tremendous successes, and we're going to hear about them today in today's report.
Excuse me, sir.
Commissioner Hardesty.
I apologize for interrupting, but this is time certain for 10 a.m.
Oh, believe it or not,
the clock hasn't been changed.
Oh,
I already
bad.
Sent a note
I just
to me.
I'm sorry.
We have like the world's largest novelty clock, and it's wrong.
I know it's wrong.
Yeah, no, it's funny because I sent a text message about 20 minutes ago. Okay, you know, it is Wednesday. Any chance we could get the large novelty clock fixed? While there have been many challenges over the past 5 years, there have also been many successes, which we will hear highlighted in today's report. We're also going to hear about a recent study of the preference policy and its impact on well-being conducted by Dr. Lisa Bates and Dr. Amy Thurber of Portland State University. I want to particularly thank all the members of the North Northeast Housing Oversight Committee for their continued diligence to see that the city delivers on its promises. I'd like to now turn it over to our panel, and first up, the panel, as I understand it, Dr. Stephen Holt from the North Northeast Oversight. He's the Oversight Committee Chair. Dr. Lisa Bates, the North Northeast Oversight Committee and a distinguished PSU professor. Leslie Goodlow, who we know from the Portland Housing Bureau. She's our Business Operations Manager. Good morning. Thank you all for being here.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Commissioner Udaly, Commissioner Fritz, President of the Council.
Hey.
Hey. How are you, Commissioner?
That's Madam
Good
President.
Good to see you. Madam President of the Council, Commissioner Hardesty, and then Mayor.
Never a dull moment, is it?
It is never a dull moment at all. It is good to be sitting here. It's amazing to think that we are in this space. I remember a few years ago when this discussion happened in early 2014. And there was consideration as to how to address a $20 million allocation to be set aside for affordable housing. And at that time, the director of the Portland Housing Bureau, Tracy Manning, was considering how they would go about doing this work. And they hired a consultant, and a variety of staff members went to different community gathered spaces to ask people to get engaged. And I, with a host of peers from the 1145 group, were approached about it. And out of that group, my peers suggested that I participate in what was, I think, three meetings to talk about what this would look like. And here we are 5 years later, still talking about what this could look like. In the time that it takes to introduce a child into the earth and they're in preschool, here we are looking at what we have accomplished. And hopefully, some of the things that have transpired have deep meaning and great significance. The other thing that was interesting about that process was, as I was considering being involved, the thing I kept hearing over and over again is, don't put your name on that. Don't put your hand on that. Don't get involved in that. You don't want to risk reputation. You don't want to risk your engagement because historically, the city's not kept its promises. We've seen this repeated over and over again. We know about the impact. We know about gentrification, displacement, and you probably don't want to put your name on that. And my response was this. We can all be critics forever. We can point at what hasn't happened, and we can shout into the darkness. Or we can determine to be different and get involved to try to lift a process, roll up our sleeves, and go to work. And so I decided that's what my approach would be, and I'm excited to say that after some ups and downs, some ins and outs, and that's what happens with change, that we have an opportunity to talk about what happens when people are willing to go to work and go to work around something meaningful and significant and make sure the promises are made, our promises kept. My attitude about being a critic is this, that don't be a louder critic than you are willing to be an investor to make something different. I don't think you have the right to merely criticize if you're not willing to go to work. And so in light of that, here we are 5 years later to talk about this incredible work. And so I am grateful for this committee that many who have been involved in a variety of other spaces and places and ways, volunteer and or professionally, have been a part of this group. Dr. Lisa Bates, Dr. T. Allen Bethel, Tristan Dallas, Dr. Karen Edwards, Jillian Siraj, Sheila Holden, Marlon Holmes, Virgie Reese, and Felicia Tripp, who've given great work to this effort. And we're going to do something a little different. I'm going to do my best to not be as verbose as I have in times past. Being a preacher and a professor, I have no shortage of words. But what we're going to do today is a little play-by-play, kind of a, with the assistance of Leslie Goodlow, the business operations manager. She will kind of go through some specifics and particulars, and I will do color commentary where necessary. And then Dr. Bates is going to color commentary.
Like a sportscaster.
The phraseology from the basketball days says you've got the play-by-play person, then you've got the one who kind of expands and elaborates. So that's kind of our role. Play-by-play will be Leslie. I will add a few comments here and there, and then we're going to turn it over and talk about what we found out regarding the preference policy, which has been probably the most challenged issue, but I think some profound insights will go along with it. Ms. Goodlow.
Well, good morning, Council. I'm going to run through the...
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
I forgot to mention that we started with $20 million, and we're now over $90 million in terms of the investment and the work, and I want to thank those who have voted and supported to get us to this space, because for every family, it matters.
So this first slide shows where we have allocated dollars over the four goal areas. And then the second, so that's the top graph is how it's been allocated, and the bottom graph is how the funds have been expended so far. And then we have about just a little over $28 million that has been committed but not expended. And then the remaining dollars are in our preventing displacement home retention program. So we've got just over $9 million left in that program. Lots of accomplishments in 2019. One of our multifamily buildings opened, the Magnolia. We had three multifamily rental projects go under start construction. The number of preference policy home purchasers increased from 7 in 2018 to 33 in 2019. And then PCRI's first home ownership development project was completed and sold to four preference policy families. This map shows you where all of the investments are through the North Northeast Housing Strategy. The blue dots are land banking. So we have two pieces of property that we purchased and are going to use for future development. We have six multifamily rental projects and three home ownership projects that are under development or will soon be.
1 second. The upper dot on the Cary Boulevard that identifies the Cary Boulevard space, that is the opportunity for home ownership. So we're super excited about that. Yes?
I just have a quick clarifying points. If you could, there may be people watching this who don't know what the preference policy is. Could you just give a quick two sentences on what we mean by that?
The preference policy is a opportunity for people that have been historic residents of Northeast Portland to be moved up on a waiting list so they can get 3 points for their own from themselves and 3 points for their parent, grandparent, or guardian having lived in Northeast Portland for a total of 6 points. And as people apply, they get put onto a list, randomized, and then we send those lists over to either our rental projects or to our home ownership partners to help select how people get apartments or houses.
Thank you for calling that. Appreciate it.
So this next slide, preventing displacement, this is our first strategy. We have, as you can see, we've had up and down in our households being assisted between with home loans, but that's because of the amount of time it takes from start to finish. So it takes about 18 months. So that's why you see we do a lot. And then the big number is those that have closed. So they start in 1 year, they close in the next year, they start in the next year, and they close. So that's why that number's up and down.
Wait, this is the preventing displacement, though.
That's home repair and home repair loans and grants.
Okay.
And so we've helped a total of 556 homes with home repair grants, but a total of 793 grants. So some families have received more than one grant over the course of the 5 years, and they're eligible to do that. And 28 families have had home repair loans, so for just about 800 households have been assisted with home repair loans and grants.
Leslie, could you please connect the dots between home repair loans and anti-displacement?
So those dollars are to assist families, mostly seniors, in repairs or upgrades to their homes in order for them to continue to stay in their home. Things like fixing roofs, adding pull-up bars, steps, ramps, doing lead paint abatement in houses. So any variety of things, painting the outside of the house so that their neighbors aren't complaining about what the house looks like. That's how we're hoping to keep people in their homes.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And it's forgivable.
Yes, so those loans are forgivable after, I believe, I'm just going to check.
15 years.
And do they have to pay it back if they sell the property within that 15 years, or?
Yes, they do.
Commissioner Daly.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a question about the loans versus grants and who's been accessing them and how that breaks down by race.
Can I'm getting ready. That's the next slide.
Okay, sorry.
Great question.
So the chart on the left shows the home repair loan households. So the colors are by year. So the first bar is African-American or black households. And then the second bar is white households. So generally, we're pretty even between black households and white households, and then other racial groups have had received fewer home repair loans. And then the grants have gone primarily to African-American households from the beginnings since 2015. So you can see that those are the total numbers by compiled into one bar.
I mean, I guess I'm curious, do a lot of people apply for loans and can't qualify for that? Like, how do you determine if someone's going to go for a loan or a grant? And do you feel like the allocation of dollars for each program is correct?
So the loan program is managed through the Bureau.
Yeah.
And there are requirements, so they can't have a reverse mortgage. So there are some criteria that would prevent people from getting a home repair loan. The grants are managed through our community partners, and those are for smaller dollar amounts. A loan can go up to $40,000. The grants are somewhere between 5 and 10, mm-hmm. and we are in the process of evaluating whether or not we should increase the grant amount to allow for more significant repairs with the grant. So someone can get their roof done, they could get their house painted, they can you know, replace furnaces, those kinds of things with grants.
Okay.
And I will add that the Oversight Committee is absolutely advocating for a greater dollar amount in the granting programming so that we can help more families that then won't have an economic impact that lasts. Our goal is not only to help people stay in their homes, but then not to give them more burden while they do that.
And I'll just say I definitely support that. I think this perhaps reflects the challenge we had early on with the home ownership program, is that if we're trying to remedy past harm to people who have been denied economic opportunity and have their housing, you know, their community taken away and their housing torn down, we can't then present them with a program that requires them to meet the qualifications.
Yeah, the same standards that we use everywhere else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so similarly, I mean, I'm very interested in delivering remedies, and I would support more money going to grants for that reason.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, the next slide is strategy 2 for creating new homeowners. And the bar graph shows we are currently separating out by funding source which pot of money people are paid, their down payment assistance is paid out of. We will be bringing forward a recommendation to the Oversight Committee at their May meeting to change the goal and to just collapse all of these into one. We'll still track it on the back so that we have one goal of how many home buyers we are trying to reach by 2022. So we have 17 that have purchased through our North Northeast Interstate TIF dollars. We have, and this was as of December 31st. This is not through right now. And then you can see the rest. You can see the slides. And then we've had 5 families that have been able to purchase a home. They came through the preference policy, they received home ownership counseling, and they were able to buy a house or receive a house without any subsidy from the city. So we're very happy that even though they don't get any money, that people are benefiting from the service that we're providing.
Are these all new homes that people are buying, or can they use the program to buy existing homes?
Most of these are market rate in the market in the interstate URA, except for the CET dollars. Those were for construction excise tax dollars. I know I'm trying not to use acronyms.
Well done.
People could use those anywhere in the city, and that was for current stock.
Thank you. Do you happen to know if any of the homeowners were descendants of any of the people who lost their homes in the eminent domain action the city took on behalf of Manual Hospital?
I don't know that, but I can find that information.
I'd love to know that.
Okay.
Thank you.
So a couple things that I wanted you to know that as of today, we have 25 North Northeast DPALs, 5 Prosper purchasers, 9 from our construction excise tax, and 6 without any subsidy. We have 82 homeownership units under development, 35 two-bedroom units and 47 three-bedroom units. And 30 of those are at 35 to 61% of AMI. 30 will be at 61 to 80% of AMI. And 22 will be at 81 to 100% of AMI.
And those AMI is?
Area median income.
Thank you.
Same effort.
Exactly.
So strategy 3 is creating rental homes. We have 3 projects that are scheduled to be completed in June or July of this year. And the Magnolia 2 opened up, and it is currently leasing. At the time we wrote this report, they were about 60% lease. Some highlights of our creating rental homes. We have exceeded the goal. We had a goal of 380 units, and we're at 501 for the housing strategy and the dollars that were allocated. 52% of the units are going to be family size, which was another one of the goals from the Oversight Committee and the information we received through the forums. We're going to be able to house approximately 1,254 people, and we're going to be able to serve very low-income families through a combination of Section 8 vouchers and PSH, permanent supportive housing. We have 80 project-based Section 8 units, 17 PSH units, and 67 units at 30% AMI. Additionally, we have 51 units at 50% and 380 units at 60%. Of the 501, there are 57 studios, 182 one-bedrooms, 189 two-bedrooms, and 73 bedrooms. Strategy 4 is land banking. As I noted earlier, we have two pieces of property currently that we are hoping to develop in the next few years. We purchased the Strong Family property on Alberta and Williams, and that came before council in August, I believe. And then we also purchased the Cary Boulevard property from the Water Bureau, and Prosper's Board approved moving that into the URA, so we'll be able to use tax increment financing to develop that property. And that one is going to be for home ownership. The next slides are around our DMWESB participation. This is for home repair. You can see both the racial breakdown and then the percentage of time. And I'm sorry, I don't have my reading glasses on.
I know that feeling.
One is grants and one is loans, I'm sorry. So that is the percentage of participation by race and ethnicity in our home repair grant and loan program.
Excuse me, Mayor.
Commissioner Hardesty.
This is the first time that Slavic shows up as a group. As I've gone through the forms that you have, and so I'm just curious, because the other charts that you show as you break down the demographics, this was the very first chart that actually started listing out the Slavic community as an individual ethnic group. And so I'm just curious if we didn't do it on like the front end when you talk about the breakdown with in other categories that you've charted. I was just curious when that category started showing up and then how you've been tracking it since then. Because I was thinking, was it in the white category before and then somebody said, no, we need a separate category, or?
That's a great question.
I can't answer that question, but we'll make sure we can get you an answer for that.
I just noticed it popped up and I was like, oh, where did that come from? And
Okay,
thank you.
That's a good question.
The next slide is for our rental construction participation, both the number of hours and then the diversity. So by group, so WBE, MBE, so the percentage of work that they're getting, and then the actual race, ethnicity, breakdown of that workforce.
So if I could stop you for just a moment before you move.
This
is one that really fascinates me. I noticed that with the minority contractors, 58% are non-certified. That's always a question in this chamber around certified versus non-certified. First, is there a demographic breakdown of the non-certified? Who are these 58% of the contractors that got the bulk of the contract dollars? Should we learn something from this experience that we haven't actually institutionalized at the City of Portland prior to this program? Those are the questions that come up when I see this, because as you may be surprised to know, we have a hard time finding minority contractors at the City of Portland. And so it would be very interesting to find out much more details about how this happened, how this worked, and how do we duplicate it in other city efforts.
Okay.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fritz.
Well,
That's, and I'm reminded by Commissioner Hardesty that the late Harold Williams Sr. Refused to become certified. He just said, look at me. And I would be interested in, of those non-certified, how many may be minority or disadvantaged people, but choose not to get certified.
And I would hope that the information we learn would help to then give us strategies around some of the barriers that impact the certification process.
Well, we already know that only 20% of minority contractors are certified by the state of Oregon because it is a very cumbersome process.
Yes, it is.
And the fact that we focus so much of our energy on that 20% of workers just makes me a little batty. So I'm fascinated when someone has found a way to actually hire minority contractors and actually get the money as compared to certifications.
Well, I appreciate your comments, having been a small business owner who's had to go through the process of certification. So.
I'll echo some of the interest and concerns expressed by my colleagues. I am interested in barriers, any barriers that you may have identified that we could work on to the MWESB issue.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Dr. Holt, you laughed when I mentioned my friend Harold. Of course, I meant Harold Williams, not Harold Washington.
Right.
I'm sure Harold Washington had the same experience.
I'm sure he did.
Sorry. That's funny, but I can't.
All right, the next slide is speaks to our policy goal around the preference policy. We did two rounds of the preference policy in 2019, one for 5020 North Interstate, which you're going to be hearing about in a little bit. That's a home ownership condo development that we had 651 applicants that claimed point preference, 115 applicants claimed eminent domain preference, and 80% identified as a race or ethnicity other than white. And then for the Magnolia 2 round, we had 717 applicants that claimed point preference, 73 claimed eminent domain preference, and 73% identified as race or ethnicity other than white. And over the many rounds of the preference policy up until the one we just did, we had 3,417 unduplicated applicants for the preference policy. So we've had quite a few people apply. And now I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Bates to talk about the study that was done by Portland State.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Myself and Dr. Ami Thurber, who's here with us today, were the investigators of this work that we conducted last summer with folks who moved into the first three buildings through the preference policy and the North-Northeast strategy. And Dr. Thurber, really, I want to make sure to credit her for her work to develop this framework that we use around individual and community well-being. We also work with some graduate students from the School of Social Work in our work to survey, interview, and do focus groups with folks living in those buildings. So there's the two on MLK and then another building over on Interstate. We have talked so much about process of the preference policy, and I think this is the first time that we've been able to, because significant numbers of people moved into these buildings, and we've been really able to talk with people about their experience. And we wanted to try to speak with them about why they chose this opportunity, what it meant to them, and what their experiences were as they, in some cases, moved back into the neighborhood or moved into more stable, affordable housing in the neighborhood. And we wanted to try to provide this information to the city, to the oversight committee, and also to help think about what other kinds of programming or resources might be important as part of the strategy moving forward. So we spoke with folks about their experiences and also their ideas about what they might like to see in their buildings and in their communities. So our first big area of finding is that indeed the preference policy is meeting the people it was intended to serve. So it is, as Leslie described, there's a not impossibly complicated, but there's some process around determining people's point ranking in the preference policy. And so we wanted to find out first, is this actually really housing the folks who have that deep and intergenerational connection in Northeast Portland? And it is. The large majority of people have lived most of their life in Northeast Portland. Again, some have more recently moved away from the community, and we found folks had been scattered throughout Portland up into far North Portland, into East Portland, but also into some suburbs who have moved back because of the policy. That the large majority of the preference policy residents are Black, reflecting the history of the neighborhood. Again, it's not a racial policy, it's a place-based policy. And we know that this was a place that was segregated and had the majority of Black folks living in Portland in Northeast. The majority are women-headed households, and in this round at least, about half do not have children living in the home, half do. These are two of the buildings don't really have many family size units. And so I think that may be a difference as we go forward with some of the buildings that have more bedroom size units.
Commissioner Hersky has a question.
Dr. Bates, do you know if recruitment was based on the size? So you got certain people applying because they knew that they didn't have kids at home, so they needed a smaller unit. You know what I mean? When the recruitment was happening, was it a broad-based recruitment, or was it very narrowly focused?
It's very broad-based recruitment onto the preference policy list, but then the sort of complication, and I think where we've had a lot of our conversation, is in the lease-up, where then the actual specific units, incomes, and people have to get matched up on the ground, right? And so moving from that very long list of people who are waiting potentially to who actually gets into the units is
and how
where
long
that,
is that
size
wait,
happens.
How long is that wait from the time we recruit to the last person on the list actually gets into a place?
Well, it depends on the round. So we just did a round, just closed it, and we're in the process of verifying points. But that was for the three buildings that are not going to be open until June or July.
Okay.
But people, as soon as we've had verified points, folks will be referred over to the property management companies, and they'll start screening people and lining people up for units that they'll be able to move in once the buildings are completed. So some cases it's going to be 3 or 4 months, and other cases it wasn't as long.
Thank you.
You ready for the next slide?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. Secondly, one of our main findings and theme is that place really does matter. The concept of the preference policy is that North and Northeast Portland is important to people, and that there needed to be an opportunity for people to continue to live there. And we also know that many people need affordable housing. What we found is that 80% of the folks that we surveyed said that their connection to the neighborhood was their primary motivation in applying for this opportunity. So place was really an important component of their prioritization. At the same time, they also did believe this was their best chance for moving from a waitlist into housing because of the preference policy, knowing that they would have an opportunity to potentially be prioritized on a waitlist was also an important finding for them, an important factor for their application. At the same time, being convenient to work or school wasn't really a primary motivation. It was really a broader sense of connection to the history of the neighborhood and the community. So 91% said the history of the neighborhood mattered to them. And when we spoke to people in interviews and focus groups, there was a lot of conversation about what it meant to be where you're familiar, where you know people, still having friends and family nearby, even with the amount of displacement that there's been, still feeling like this is a sense of home and familiarity. I know how to be here and how to get around from here. And the vast majority, over 85%, still said they feel like they belong in the neighborhood, even with the changes that they've seen.
So
and
Dr.
have friends
Bates,
and family.
Commissioner Hurst,
I'm fascinated by this particular part of your survey because as I was reading it, I was thinking, and I wonder where those people shop. And I wonder what their favorite restaurants are in their neighborhood. And I wonder if there are cultural norm places that are gathering spots. And mm-hmm. so on one hand, when I think about how wonderful to be able to afford to live in a neighborhood that you have a 30-plus year history, but we don't live in our place, right? We have to engage in a broader community. So what's the experience once you walk out that affordable door into restaurants that may or may not be welcoming and may or may not have what you consider your cultural norms? Did people talk about that?
Yes, so that was part of our framework as well. And if we go forward, we'll see some of those tensions. I would say it's an experience in which, one, people are, overwhelmingly relieved by their housing situation, and they feel very connected to the neighborhood, and they feel a sense of, like, yeah, I am here, and I belong here, and also there are some tensions and challenges around the things that you described. On the positive side, in terms of improvements to well-being, and keeping in mind that there are a substantial number of people who are moving back to Northeast from neighborhoods where they may have not felt as comfortable, welcomed, or have the infrastructure in place the physical infrastructure and social infrastructure that does exist or is more accessible from Northeast Portland. Many people are saying they've increased their participation in art and cultural events, for example. I think we talked to a number of people, like, very soon after Good in the Hood. And so that was a reference point of, like, it's just up the street to be able to go to that festival and have that access. About half of people are spending time volunteering, and a quarter of those folks said they have increased their engagement in that way since moving in. And about half say that getting to work and school is more convenient. Although that wasn't a major motivating factor, they were having more convenience. And again, the transit options, the walkability, clearly better than for folks who were living in the eastern part of the city in East County.
That piques my interest as transportation commissioner. There was a recent Harvard study on upward mobility that found that commute time was the single biggest determinant of a family's ability to lift themselves up out of poverty. And when I saw that stat, was it 80% didn't identify getting to work and school?
About 50%.
No,
the previous slide.
Oh, sorry.
Oh.
Convenience to work or school is not a primary.
Was not a primary
percentage,
factor.
But yes. 50% have
had
improvement.
Yes,
I'd be interested if we could some other time drill down into that a little bit more. I'm wondering if people have just become so acclimated to having to have unreasonable commutes that that's why it wasn't indicated. But then they move and realize it has an impact. Anyhow.
Right.
Dr. Bates, could I ask just a
yes,
couple?
Of course.
And I'm sorry that we're interrupting. That's a sign that we're really interested in this subject.
You have more questions than my students will this afternoon. It's the last day of class, so we're all tired.
And they might surprise you. You never know. First of all, maybe I'm just stating the obvious. You went to individuals who already have been engaged in this policy. And they voluntarily submitted this information. What was your response rate?
Oh, so in our survey, quite high. We surveyed most of the people who are housed through the preference policy in each building, and then also interviewed probably about 35 people across the buildings.
Great. And the reason I raise that is there's some things, obviously, we would not ask and housing authorities would not ask as people are seeking the housing. And I just wanted to clarify that this is a post-housing survey where people voluntarily chose to participate.
Absolutely, yes.
I wanted to make that crystal clear,
so,
particularly the racial data.
In our world and the university, we take great care to protect the confidentiality and anonymity of folks who participate in our research. This research is actually resourced from Portland State University, is not by the Housing Bureau. So we're not reporting on people in any way to the City of Portland or any housing provider. And that's a conversation we have very clearly with everyone as we survey and have interviews and focus groups. And I will say that the conversations that we had, I think, were quite frank about their experiences in the buildings with providers, with management, as well as in the community at large. So we're sharing here more this kind of high-level experiences that people are having and thinking about the neighborhood and how it relates to the policy and strategy at large. But we will be continuing to share out more information, again, in a confidential, in an anonymized sort of aggregated way to providers, and then also coming back around to community again to talk with them about what we heard from them. So we have shared that building by building with everyone who participated in the research, was able to see what the results were, and then we'll have a larger community gathering once this time of community gathering may resume.
Very good. And my second question is related to, and maybe you'll talk about this, in which case I'll stop, but the level of knowledge that people had about the preference policy, where did they learn about it? Do we have a sense of that?
I don't off the top have, I know we asked about that, but I don't off the top have a good response to that. I think there were a lot of avenues that people were finding out about the policy that they talked about. A lot of folks sort of through personal networks, like heard about it and then sought out the information, but that's something that I can come back around with.
Thanks so much.
I'll just make one more comment, and that is that I share Commissioner Hardesty's interest and concern about kind of the larger cultural fabric around those residences. And
let's go to the next slide.
We'll go to the next slide.
Cool.
Yes.
And whether, okay.
Yes, because
I'm going to stop talking now. I might have to say something else.
But. This place and community matter a lot to folks, and they speak about their connection and feeling that they should be in the community, and also reported mixed experiences, feelings, and some risks to their well-being living in the community as it has changed so dramatically. Fewer than half of the people felt that if they wanted to find a good job in the neighborhood, that would be possible for them. Some folks are still quite precariously housed. They are very cost burdened, even living in a regulated unit, and they were worried about their ability to kind of hang on, even again in a subsidized regulated unit.
And is that at 80% of MFI or AMI or?
Most of the units are
60%,
right? Yes.
Wow.
Or lower. Most of those interviewed, to your point, Commissioner Hardesty, described a need for more low-cost stores and amenities. So groceries, absolutely, restaurants, both in terms of cost and also in terms of a feeling of welcoming and inclusion. And while about 70% agree that people of different backgrounds get along in the community, over a third did say there was a lot of prejudice in the neighborhood, and about a third had experienced discrimination in area businesses. So people are having some challenges. We had conversations around conflicts with neighbors, for example, around parking cars. And that may happen in many contexts where there are multifamily buildings being built, but here there is an additional kind of layer around race and class that may create additional tensions.
I have I'm just fascinated by this, because I think that we can learn a lot by whether or not we are really helping people be grounded in a community that they love, or whether we are actually isolating people from the ability to fully experience a community, regardless of what community it may be. And so as you were talking, I'm thinking about we talk about like restaurants, walking in the door, and all people of color know, walking in the door of a restaurant and sitting down and knowing that you're not going to get served, right? Or it's going to be a very long process, or people look at you weird when you walk in. I am very interested in more data around just how people are experiencing being in a community that is 100 times different than the community they were raised in and grew up in, and the cultural markers no longer exist. And so what's our job as a city to develop a community in places where people were shocked to find out people of color and people who spoke different languages actually were now living all around them. What's our role in making sure that we're not just isolating people in places that they are barely holding on financially, and then there's no cultural resources that are there for their benefit?
I think that's a great point, and I don't want to interrupt. I want to add two things. That what you highlight is the conversation I had with our prior mayor when we began this process, that it's more than just building spaces. It's also community development. And how do we put in some processes to address acclimating those who have no idea or value of the history and why this would even matter? They don't care. They're paying market rate. They've built their businesses, et cetera. What do we do beyond just sticks and bricks? And so the challenge for me is that our committee has its charge, and you do the work of what the charge is. But within that, how do we then try to take advantage of the other opportunities? Now, I'll add one other piece, that it's not just helping people move back. It's also how do we help people in space and in place where they find themselves in these new communities that have transitioned. So this is only one part. It's only one piece. It's only one element, but it's a valuable element and a valuable piece and a significant one as we're talking about. But the nuances are incredible, and I'd love for us to spend some time thinking through how do we influence really developing healthy community and not just spaces, but how do we approach this whole thing. So,
right. Well, I'll just briefly finish by saying I'm the new liaison to Venture Portland. So I'm going to be much more involved in conversations with the small business community. I'm particularly interested in how the city can create a better kind of avenue for small businesses to give us feedback on how our work is impacting them. I'm interested in how we can help protect our legacy businesses, especially culturally specific or minority-owned businesses in North Northeast Portland, and then how we can support an expansion of those, not just businesses, cultural centers, and other amenities that people want to see. Because even though the African American demographics in North Northeast have flipped, we still have a significant population there relative to the central city, right? So it's not like people are returning to a community where the Black community was entirely erased. There's something to build on, and any way I can participate in that conversation and support, I'm really interested.
Well, I think our you know, interim, our question at the end of this phase of the research, and we do intend to repeat this process with the new buildings that are coming on in the summer to continue to build this knowledge. The space that we landed on was asking exactly this set of questions. We have a housing strategy. What if we had a community strategy? What would that look like? Yep. The residents of the buildings already have articulated a number of their own ideas, both for themselves, for people living in the building with them, but also in the way that they might integrate and connect with people in the community, with talking about community history and the things they would like to see around them. And so I think as we move forward and continuing those conversations in the community, we'll be able to surface those kinds of ideas for community development programming. And I do think the question is, where do those go in right. the space if we right. don't really have a community development function right. at the city of Portland?
We do. It's called Prosper Portland today.
Yeah, an economic development function, but more around the civic, cultural, and community building space. How do we create that through through, I think, a range of partnerships of community-based organizations, philanthropy, the city, et cetera.
Social acclimation. We help people learn how to live together, right?
Right. It has to be about more than just housing, and we recognize that in
Absolutely.
Many ways. And next steps would be to find out what could that look like, and how can that be resourced.
And I guess, is that part of your process? Is that part of your next step, or is that part of somebody else's next step?
I think we see ourselves as partners in that next step, and certainly in terms of convening in community. So I presented this in a longer format to the last Oversight Committee meeting. Again, we're planning on a community forum where we can share this out with everyone, but also have lots of generative conversation around what folks are interested in seeing. Now it's 6 months later, so they probably have different experiences and ideas at this point.
If you get the date nailed down, I'd love to participate.
Absolutely.
But it's on my calendar. If I don't know 2 months ahead of time, chances are really hard. So.
Absolutely.
Well, I would say, Commissioner, it would be excellent to have that conversation and think about how we craft something that really looks at how communities get developed. I don't know that it exists from a holistic standpoint, but it would be fantastic. The conversations that this Oversight Committee has had have been very much along the lines of everything you've articulated, and the limitation is we have what we have. We have to deal within the confines of the structure of the work that we've been charged with. So it would be awesome to think about how we can do city and do city.
So the last two slides are yours.
You know what? I'm going to speak from my heart. Danger, danger, danger. What you illustrate is some of the opportunity and some of the accomplishment and the challenge around this work. It has been 5 years of rolling our sleeves up and doing our best to make sure that city partners, that nonprofit partners, and others do business differently. This hasn't been done before. This is the very first of its kind. And I think we've accomplished some significant things. And at the same time, we have significant challenges that remain, some that are beyond our scope and some that are within our realm. And I'm going to go out on a limb here. And the limb I'm going to go out on is what impacts me around this reality. I'm native to the city of Portland, and I happen to be and have been for a few years now a 6'3 black man. And in every environment I go into, I'm a 6'3 black man. Before I'm Dr. Holt, before I'm professor, before I'm pastor, before I'm influencer, before I'm consultant, before I'm a 6'3 black man. I know the impact of being in these spaces. I also have been a recipient of Section 8 and so forth, and I know the dynamic of living as somebody who's looked down upon, who needs assistance to get up. The value of this work and the significance of this work and the opportunity of this work cannot be underestimated. We have an obligation to do something meaningful in this city, and it's going to take all of us to do it. We celebrate what we've accomplished, but by no means is this the summit. By no means do we stand here and say we've arrived. We've done some good things for some good people. We've got a lot more to do. I always say it, I'll say it again. It is time to make sure that the promises made are promises kept. Thank you very much.
Beautiful. I'll entertain a motion.
Move to accept the report.
Second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Fritz, a second from Commissioner Hardesty. Any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Prince. Thank you. Thank you for the partnership with the Housing Bureau, the community, Portland State University, Dr. Bates. I have one request when you do the report next year. On page one, it says it's part of the history and the charter. In March 2014, Mayor Charlie Hales, with the support of Housing Commissioner Dan Saltzman, dedicated an additional $20 million in tax increment financing dollars from the Interstate Urban Renewal District to affordable housing to begin to address the ongoing threat of displacement and gentrification. So next year, would you add, and the support of Shadow Housing Commissioner Nick Fish?
Yes.
I, under Mayor Hales' administration, there were basically three housing commissioners. There were three people who cared so passionately about this. So when this was presented to me, I was like, that sounds good. I also, so that's just,
it's important to give that credit.
Yes, agreed.
And I think your words at the end, Dr. Holt, Commissioner Fish would echo those as well. Yeah. Promises made need to be promises kept. Last year when we had this presentation, I think there were a lot of comments to the extent of, is that all? Or what's next? What's more? This year, it's clear that you've stuck with the program, you've run the course, you've continued doing the good work, you've modified it in response to the good research that Dr. Bates has done to produce even better results, and it's really working. And so it was fascinating to get the demographics of, or the information about the number of families, people returning who still have friends and family in the neighborhood. There's so much work to be done, and yet you are making really, really good progress. So congratulations and thank you. Aye.
Hardesty.
I think Commissioner Fritz was talking about me. I do want to say, when I first heard about this policy, I had some colorful words, because in my mind, if we were not centering race to address racially discriminatory policy, how could we possibly actually serve the people we say we are going to serve? It is clear that the preference policy has centered African-American experience in the interstate urban renewal area and has prioritized those individuals coming back. It is easy for me to say when I was wrong. I was wrong. We are starting to have an impact on a small number of people who have 30-plus years of lived experience in the city of Portland. I am giddy about the housing units that Proud Ground and others are doing that will come online this summer, because when people talk to me about affordable housing, that's actually housing people can afford to live in who work for a living in the city of Portland, when we are talking at 60% of area median income and below. You know, people can figure out a way to live comfortably when they're working 2-3 minimum wage jobs in housing with that criteria. Yes, last year I was woefully disappointed in the number of people who we had moved into home ownership opportunities, and that has increased. But I do certainly understand from talking to housing providers how difficult the process is to prepare people to be ready for home ownership opportunities, especially if you've been living by the seat of your pants for the last decade or so. I don't believe that I was inappropriate in my questioning of Dr. Holt last year. I think I did what I do with everyone, try to hold them accountable to what they say they will do. I want to applaud the team, the Oversight Committee, with standing firm and being clear about what the objectives were and holding everyone accountable to those outcomes. I want to appreciate the fact that this is the the most diverse contracting field that the City Council has ever seen presented in front of us. I have many, many, many questions about that we can unpack later. But I want you to know that you have my absolute respect and appreciation for all the volunteer time that this committee has put in to steering this in a way that makes us proud here on the City Council, that we actually can point to something that we made a commitment to, and we are starting to see the results of that commitment. Are we done? Not by a long shot. Are we satisfied with where we are? I'm not. And I don't think anybody in this room is. But do we see a path for the future? Absolutely we do. But as we've talked about today, you can't just pluck people down in a community and expect somehow it's going to all be like a tossed salad, because that's just not how people roll, not today in this environment that we're in. So we have an obligation to not just isolate people in communities, but to actually really make sure we're building strong communities where everyone can be prosperous. I am very happy to vote aye on this report and look forward to digging into the rest of that research and finding out what else does the city need to do to ensure that we are walking our talk and not just doing whatever the shortest, most efficient thing is to do. I vote aye.
Thank you, Daly.
Well, I just got so lost in Commissioner Hardesty's words, I can't remember what I was going to say. I want to talk about those broken promises in further detail sometime. And that term is perhaps a little too kind. We instituted social engineering through racist public policy.
Absolutely.
For decades. And we have an obligation to remedy that. And broken promises is part of it. So I'm looking forward to that conversation moving forward. I want to appreciate the work of the Oversight Committee and of Dr. Bates and Dr. Thurber in looking at the impact of the preference policy on well-being. I'm just so fascinated by this work because while housing is a basic need and a human right and absolutely the right place to start, it's not enough. We want to know that people are actually better off, that their quality of life is improved, that they're able to build wealth, and that they're headed towards a healthier, more vibrant future, not just that we've stuck them in a box in the neighborhood of their choice. As always, I want to thank Bishop Holt and Leslie Goodloe. I feel like it's been a long time since I've seen you. So nice to see you again for everything you've done for the North Northeast Housing Strategy and continuing to guide council through this important work. I vote aye.
Thank you.
Wheeler.
Well, I hope former Commissioner Dan Saltzman is watching. Last year, I think all of us were very disappointed with the results, and I don't think it was because of anything that the committee was doing or anything the Housing Bureau was doing. It was just a very radical idea in its conception. And I liked to tell Dan Saltzman, despite his best efforts to appear otherwise, he really is a radical at heart. And this is one example of where this was a new idea. It was a fresh idea. It was an out-of-the-box idea. And along with my colleagues last year, as we were looking at the results into year four, frankly, we were wondering whether it was ever going to amount to much of anything. It was not living up to its promise. But boy, what a difference 1 year has made. Dr. Holt, thank you for your persistence and your leadership. And I will extend that to the entirety of the North Northeast Oversight Committee.
Great.
You guys could have walked away from it, and you didn't. You stuck to it, you doubled down, and you've made it work. I also, Leslie, I want to thank everybody in the Housing Bureau, and I see Shannon, Director Callahan in the back. You took some heat for this. Last year was my recollection.
A little bit.
You stuck to it. You stuck to it. And Dr. Bates and Dr. Thurber, I want to thank you for giving us some objective analysis of what people who are actually directly impacted by this program are telling us about the program in terms of whether we're hitting the right center, whether we're hitting the right objectives, whether we're actually achieving the goals that we set out to accomplish. I'm actually very encouraged by the results that you put forth today. So it took a little while to build the momentum, but it feels like it's here. And that's exciting to me. And so I hope you leave feeling that your work has been validated and that you're on the right track and that we're getting somewhere. You're right, Dr. Holt. We're not there yet, but we're heading in the right direction. We're taking the steps and we're seeing the progress behind us. So thank you for your leadership. I'm very happy to vote aye. Report's accepted.
Thank you.